Hello and welcome to Whom Pods Destroy. I'm Terry DeFellin. If you're new to this podcast, then thanks very much for listening. This is a podcast that focuses on the original series of Star Trek, of which I am the host, and I'm joined by Derek Mantle and Graham Sibley. In this edition, we discuss a Stonewall classic episode, The Corbomite Maneuver. This was the first regular episode of Star Trek produced, although not the first ever to be aired on TV. It sets its stall out for what we can expect Star Trek to be and establishes a template for all good Star Trek stories hereafter. We hope you like this episode and enjoy our discussion, and we recommend that you watch the episode before listening to the podcast.
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
This is the captain speaking. First Federation vessel is in distress. We're preparing to board it. There are lives at stake. By our standards, alien life. But lives nevertheless. Captain out.
Course plotted and laid in, sir.
Jim, don't you think...
What's the mission of this vessel, Doctor? To seek out and contact alien life. And an opportunity to demonstrate what our high-sounding words mean.
Hello, and welcome. I'm Terry, and as ever, I'm joined by Derek.
Hello.
And by Graham.
Hello.
And our discussion today is going to be about the Corbomite Maneuver, first season episode of Star Trek, and the first season episode of Star Trek.
First production one. Yeah.
Or is it?
Mm.
And this is what I want to come on to, because I want to actually mention briefly the music in this episode, because it's worth bringing up early doors, because yeah. Fred Stein is the composer of the music, and it's a very, very distinctive, very memorable soundtrack, and was reused quite a lot throughout the season. But listening and watching it back for this podcast, I noticed something that I already knew but never really put it together, that if this was the first production episode of Star Trek, there's music that's being used in this episode that comes from subsequent episodes of Star Trek. There's music from Balance of Terror, there's music from Charlie X, to name two, and there may well be music from others, which come later in production, which I find interesting. But then when I was reading up, I found that this was the first production episode, but that the effects took so long to do that it wasn't finished. So I'm wondering whether or not actually it took so long to make that by the time they'd finished it, they had scores and cues from other episodes in the can, so to say, which they then used in included in this episode.
Almost certainly. There is another story I read Bob Justman wrote about the fact that they had a lot of shots, the sort of thing from like the view screen shots. They'd have Sulu turning around looking worried towards the captain.
Mm.
And those were stock shots that they would use as filler shots. And so they would film these
so that when they could. Flowing, going down the majestically and the plane were actually playing there and then it turns around. No?
They just basically had a clear screen there and like they always did. So it would be whenever they need it, they just drop in whatever they wanted there.
But I actually read that they left in the original version, they had left the screen blank on one shot or something.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, I don't know about that.
You have to look on your original.
Might have to have a look at the original. I must confess, I've only watched the remastered. I didn't take a moment to watch the original version. I don't know whether or not you did, because, I mean, you've got Netflix now, Graham.
I know,
as has been established before, which we're all very excited about. We're happy for you. We're happy for you that you have Netflix. It's like a new arrival. It's lovely news.
Yeah, it's great.
I'll write you a card later. Did you watch this episode on Netflix, or did you watch it?
Yeah, of course I watched it on Netflix. I'm not going to watch it on... I'm not going to get my DVD out, am I?
Like a loser.
Like some kind of rube. What are you taking me for, man?
Well, I'm really interested to learn, because obviously to an extent we kind of relied on you previously because you didn't have Netflix and you didn't have the remasters, because you haven't got the remasters on DVD. You've only got the original ones. But it's the same as me.
Yeah.
I've got them right over there and I love them. They're precious. I never, ever, ever use them
Yeah.
because I've got Netflix, so why the hell would I? But I was just interested to see whether or not, you know, you had any observations about the unremastered versions about this by comparison.
Well, I did go through the YouTube clip because the good people on oh, I'm forgetting the name of the site now, but they've produced for all the TOS episodes. They've produced a side-by-side analysis of the original and the remastered.
Of course, I know those people as well.
Yes.
I'll post a link on the show notes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, yeah. And this one for the Corbomite Maneuver is perhaps the longest one out of a lot of them. It's actually in two parts, in 2 9.5-minute chunks, because there is just so much that they've done it. But they've done such a sympathetic job on it. It really, really is one of the best examples of remastering, where they've actually taken the original concepts, looked at the original designs, and actually just tweaked them for an HD audience. Mm. And I think that's the perfect thing about it. That's what they've done with this. And it works really, really well with what they've done.
For Christmas, my wife got the Roddenberry Vault, which is a DVD or a Blu-ray of a selection of episodes and a stack of outtakes and whatnot, which I didn't get the opportunity to watch myself, but they did have remastered versions of selection of episodes, two of which are the Corbomite Maneuver, and the other one is the subject of our next episode, which is Arena. And so I actually watched the cold open for the Corbomite Maneuver in the original version just to see how it compared. And it was a lovely, it's lovely, because they've cleaned that up as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks lovely.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is the thing that you do forget about with these, with the remasters against the old ones, is that, you know, even the uniform colours and that, the colours are really washed out on the old prints,
yeah,
whereas the new one, they all look great. And the thing that struck me about the Corbomite Maneuver is the reflection from the warning buoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The way that it comes through, first of all, the way it reflects on the Enterprise itself, which is obviously a remastered effect. But even on the old version, you had that reflection coming through, although it's not as crisp and not as bold as it is on the remastered. And it's a lovely effect which just sets off this, what is an extremely colourful episode of Star Trek. But I think it exemplifies what you say about how it really services that episode really well. Because my first thought when I first saw the Corbomite Maneuver remaster, I thought, well, I wonder if they completely change the Phasarius and the Warning Buoy. And they don't.
No.
I mean, they do. But I mean, the design is exactly the same, just more detailed and more refined, more crisp, and it looks lovely.
Yeah, and the scout ship as well comes off it, and it looks like a part of the ship has just broken away from it. And that's
it is good, because obviously the aesthetic is going to be different in the 1960s, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I mean, you can make the mistake of looking at something like that and saying, oh, that's cheap. And you say, oh, okay, well, yeah, you're right, it is cheap. It's 1960s television. But you then don't say, oh, well, then it's cheap, so we'll completely change it and do it with something else.
Yeah.
You say, no, the aesthetic is still valid. It's just, you know, you could make it look a little bit better now.
And you see the mistake they do make in it with the chronometer.
Yes.
Because although they try to keep the aesthetic of the 1960s there,
yeah,
it's just turned into this digital thing rather than this lovely rolling analogue thing, which although looks really dated now, is part of the thing.
Analog's made a comeback. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah. I was thinking about that, because I mean, I think we half joked about this the last time we talked about digital versus, you know, the original versus remastered, about those chronometers. I think when they did them back then, it was fine. But actually, if they were to remaster TOS now, I wouldn't mind betting that they would keep some of the analog elements in, particularly those chronometers, because people are into their vinyl now, aren't they? They like the analog. They're kind of, you know, they're looking for more visceral stuff. So I think they would have liked that more.
Yeah.
So even perhaps that's dated, the remastered. So.
Well, I mean, going forward a couple of decades to the Abraham Star Trek movie, you know, obviously
Abrams.
Abrahams. Okay, yeah. Abrahams.
Abraham Lincoln.
Okay. And the thing is the thing that was really exciting when we heard that they were going to do this brand new, you know, reboot of Star Trek was is that they said that they were going to try and keep the aesthetic of the original series, you know, and the designs, and to a certain extent they did, you know. I think they actually did a very good job in the
yeah.
movie.
Yeah,
you know, they tried to keep
it. Depends what you mean by keeping the aesthetic, because some people will think that should go a lot deeper than others. Some people might say, yeah, we're going to be wearing different color shirts. That might be as far as they imagine.
It was like a lot of, you know, the Star Trek has become sort of a design classic as such. And that's where they took, you know, some of the, obviously the update and the uniforms. Even the Enterprise looks really lovely, actually. In the,
yeah.
I really like it.
In the Abrams films.
Yeah, and yeah. It looks, you know, sleek.
You're a fan of that.
Yeah, thing. Of that. But it's a different thing, you know. Yeah. The only thing I really hate is obviously the light show that goes on throughout the whole film. But overall, it's got that sort of nice sort of feel, you know, not overcomplicated. That's the thing. It's not overcomplicated. And
the whole thing about the aesthetic in the 60s one is to make it look good on colour TV. And
yeah,
this is what this episode really does. And because of especially with the Warning Boy, and you know, as you were saying about how the light shines on the outside of the ship in the remastered version, there is that great scene in the original as well when they're looking at the view screen and the lights are rotating. They've obviously got some kind of rotating thing where the view screen should be, but the colours are changing and they're sweeping across the whole of the bridge, which you know, didn't need updating at all. That works brilliantly well on the way.
It's quite interesting because there's an area of fandom where they make a big deal about the fact that the screen is actually a projection, not a window. And so to what extent that light coming through, does that actually, should that be real? Because it's almost like it's a window, but in fact it's not a window. And then there's an argument about the fact that on the Abrams movies it is a window, and indeed on Discovery it's not a window, and that's an area of controversy.
But
it's interesting what you say about those Abrams movies, because in Star Trek Beyond, Kirk uses a line from the Corbomite Maneuver, because obviously it's the 50th anniversary celebration, and so he uses a line from the Corbomite Maneuver. He uses...
You know, the greatest danger facing us is ourselves. An irrational fear of the unknown. But there's no such thing as the unknown. Only things temporarily hidden, temporarily not understood.
I'd like to just move on a bit to a discussion about the theme of this episode and the themes of this episode. Because it's, for me, an extremely well-constructed, well-put-together episode. It's very nicely paced, and there's lots of really good character moments in there. And I think that the one of the things about it is the threat of Baylock and the Viserys, and the way in which they deal with the stress of all of that. In order for Kirk to try and help the crew to be able to manage this, he gives them these little speeches and pep talks. Even at the end when they're all saying, oh, why are you rescuing this guy? He tried to kill us. He said, well, you know, because we're good people, and that's what good people do. This is for me, this is a Roddenberry episode, even though he didn't actually write it. But it's, for me, it's got these early hallmarks of what a Star Trek series is going to be.
Yes.
It's like a pilot episode.
Oh, it certainly is. I mean, you've got aspects to it that are... There's like the little tiny touches, like the way that Kirk does the shipwide communication. And I think he does it twice in this episode. Really as a sort of primer for the viewers at home to tell them why they're acting the way they do, what they're doing, and why they're doing it. Rather than saying that in a captain's log or something like that, or in discussions with the other bridge team. Just to give you a few primers as to, right, this is what this ship's all about, and this is what they will be doing however long they can survive being cancelled.
But it's quite interesting, isn't it, David? Because also they got this character Dave Bailey, which is a great name, although he's never called Dave in the actual... Who's Dave Bailey? Exactly. For our international listeners, Dave Bailey is a very old, very well-established photographer. Anyway, but I read a really good review by a guy called Darren Mooney, who's an extremely accomplished TV and film critic, who... he's still quite young and I don't think he's quite well established, but his stuff is really, really good. And he was talking about Bailey and about how Bailey reflects the audience because he's the newbie, so to speak. He's inexperienced, and all the rest of the crew are dealing with this crisis as well-trained Starfleet officers does, apart from the new guy who's freaking out. And perhaps he's kind of he's communicating to the audience, look, this is a big deal, this is serious stuff, because this guy's freaking out, even though everyone else is being dead calm about it.
Yeah, I mean, going back to this, the whole thing, actually, because you said that this is the third, well, it's the first in production, would have been the third episode originally, but it was shown in the 10th. So this is an introduction episode. It's the first, it's a pilot, isn't
it's
it?
It's like a pilot. It's, I mean, a pilot. It's not a pilot.
It's a season opener. Isn't
yeah.
It?
Yeah. And the way the characters are actually being shown to the audience, and you're right, you've got an everyman there with Bailey, and everyone else is really polished and professional. That's really nice about it. But they've also got a sense of camaraderie. He's the fish out of water. Later on, there's a little scene with Kirk and McCoy, where McCoy's actually going on about, did you actually promote this guy a bit too early?
Yeah.
I'm especially worried about Bailey. Navigator's position's rough enough. Seasoned man.
I think he'll cut it.
Condition alert. Battle station. Not so sure. Because you spotted something you liked in him? Engineering. Something familiar? Like yourself, say about 11 years ago?
On the double, Deck 5. Give me a green light.
That's the good thing about this episode, yeah, because the thing is that in the countdown, in that period when Baylock says you've got like 10 minutes left, all of the crew members have all got their little ticks, haven't they? Their little nervous ticks about how they're managing this situation. Spock's is to, you know, talk about chess and doesn't know what, because he runs out of ideas. You know, Sulu is obsessed with providing a countdown.
Mm.
You know, and you've got Bailey freaks out completely, obviously, and then, you know, then you've got McCoy who, you know, because it was foreshadowed earlier in the episode, you know, he goes back. I mean, like, they've got 3 minutes left to live, and he is belly aching with the captain about the way he's treated a member of his team. Mm. You know, I mean, like, this is not an appropriate conversation piece. But the fact of the matter is that everybody is just so stressed, and this is how they're trying to deal with this very, very difficult situation. I think it's really well written. It's actually a really mature script, actually.
It's really well directed. Yes, Joe Sargent does an excellent job.
His only Trek episode.
Yeah, so. Well, they wanted him back. Roddenberry asked him over and over and over yeah. again to get him back on there, but he went on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, he was... Yeah, that was unfortunate. But I think Gene Coon brought him in.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, he's a Man from U.N.C.L.E. guy. He did loads of Man from U.N.C.L.E. stuff, and that's probably another reason why he wasn't in on Star Trek that much. Is probably because that is a show that was really, really popular at the time, and probably much more popular than Star Trek. And so maybe that's one of the reasons why.
I'm quite interested in the directing style of this, because if you look at the way it's introduced right from the beginning, there's that shot right at the start when the camera is up at the top. And you see everyone from, a bird's eye view in Spock and everything. And it's just like the introduction in the original pilot with Captain Pike and exactly the same way.
Well, they use the same shot from the Enterprise as well, although it's not Joe Sargent, it's a stock shot, which they use in the cage, funnily enough, when they introduce us to the Enterprise.
And the from Spock here.
Yeah, it has the same.
Is a shot for shot from the cage, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's a lot of Spock, where no man has gone before Spock in this. Yes. He's a lot more abrasive. He's a lot more emotional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, we've talked about how Spock is emotional and emotes when he's suppressing his emotions, but this is not. He is more openly emotional in these episodes.
Apparently, Joe Sargent actually helped him develop the character in this as well, and actually gave him more of the sort of when you're saying about the reactions. In this sort of final countdown bit, he was the one telling him to be more stoic, and I think this is the first time he actually comes up with the line "fascinating." The first time he uses that.
I can't see how he would have used it in the cage or where no man has gone before. Yeah. No, certainly. Yes.
But I think it so that although Joe Sargent only did one episode, I think he's got his legacy perhaps lives on in the development of Spock.
Very, not only Spock, but also the relationship between Kirk and McCoy.
Yes.
Because that's just like the Pike.
That's brilliant. I think they presumably have lifted that from the scenes in the cage, haven't they, with Pike and Boyce. And that, I mean, I really enjoyed that informality between, particularly in Kirk's quarters when, you know, he's still having a bit of a go about Bailey and about how he's pushing them too hard and what are you going to do with that 5%, Jim?
Yeah.
All of that. I mean, I really like that. And this is mature, if you like, banter between two colleagues who have known each other clearly a long time. And it feels like the Enterprise as an office, like a workspace, rather than sort of like people boldly going, this is people just dealing with kind of...
They're professionals.
Working. Yeah, professionals. Yeah.
Very much an office, because there's a lot of casual sexism to the secretary as well, isn't there?
Yeah, but then again, it's a beefcake episode with Kurt, because you see him, you know, sweating while he's doing his...
His physical.
You see his arse quite a bit, so, you know, the camera...
Actually, that lovely shot when he walks onto the bridge is brilliant as well, out of the turbo.
Yeah.
Again, we spotted this one last time as well, I think, with the shot coming out of the turbo lift, and we didn't remember seeing it.
This one was a tracking shot, whereas I think the other one was a static shot.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yes, having said, oh, I don't think we've done that. Yes, they had. And in the next episode, we're going to see that.
It's always that way, isn't it?
I like the staff meeting for that same reason, just because you go to that extra professionalism when everyone's there. And I really like the fact that they're all pouring coffee, they've been there for hours. Uhura is sat there like bored out of
But it looks like us now, actually.
A bit like us now, yeah.
Well, I think that one's really interesting, because I know you said about pacing, and I think that's perhaps one criticism that can be levied against this episode, is the fact that the pacing, because the story isn't that involving, it's just a general chase, basically, isn't it? And some peril. It's difficult to pace, but the music does such a good job on it, and it's difficult to try and get that whole situation where you've got a briefing room full of really bored, frazzled people who are out of ideas and like they've been there for an age,
got nowhere.
You've got to try and build that across and try and get the viewers to sort of grasp that. Well, that happened to make them feel bored and strung out at the same time.
Well, that's maybe why you don't see that sort of type of scene very often.
No. Yeah.
Similar to that, because I think that they've come. Obviously, this is quite one of the earlier episodes, and they are constructing the whole of the format for the rest of the episodes to come later on. And they're trying out things that will work, things that don't.
Yeah.
You know, and you could say this is probably has more effect as a pilot than other episodes later, you know, that were predecessors to this.
Yeah.
You know, you put the template down, you really refine it and chip away at it.
But the only reason this wasn't earlier on in the running order was because the broadcasters didn't want it to be one of the early ones, because it wasn't anything to do with the quality, it was the content.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted Strange New Worlds. So out of those earliest episodes, the best fit for that one was Mantra.
Yeah, the Salt Vampire. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's cool, let's use that.
Yeah, and not whether or not it was any good or not.
It was a bit like a Lost in Space episode, I thought.
Well, no, exactly. Yeah. And but giving them a bit of familiarity. Yeah. If you promise them Strange New Worlds and Strange New Civilizations, then you better deliver on that.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. So many other reasons, because this is an entirely ship-based one, and actually a really, really good one when you consider them against all the other entirely ship-based ones, then you can see why it trickled down in the running order.
But it does have that echoes of your classic bottle episodes. It reminds me a lot of Balance with Terror, because there's a lot going on in the bridge.
Yeah.
And this one is essentially a bridge-based episode. And of course it has echoes of Submarine Adventures and stuff, which are very popular genre movies at the time. And it plays in nicely to that.
And I noticed the ambience on the bridge that you don't hear as much. There's a lot more communication stuff.
There's a lot more chatter, which you get less of in subsequent episodes.
And I really like that.
I was watching it the first time I watched it for this episode, I watched it with headphones for the first time ever on Netflix. And you could really hear the chatter. It was much more pronounced even than before. This also, the birth of another Star Trek trope. This was pointed out on Darren Mooney's blog, which I'll leave a link in for the show notes as well. And that's technobabble. But obviously technobabble used as technobabble rather than as a way of actually finishing up a plot line that you've got yourself into a bit of a hole about. Corbomite, you know, nonsense, obviously, and used as a bluff, as a way of you know, trying to prolong their stay of execution, try to move things forward, because Kirk, obviously the Enterprise and Kirk have run out of ideas. There's nothing they can do. They're hopelessly outmatched. The only thing they can do is try and outthink Baylock, and we'll come to Baylock in a moment. This is a really good idea, I think, because they've got, you know, technobabble is something that is so synonymous with Star Trek, but not necessarily for the usual reasons. The idea of it now being used, this kind of plot device, I thought was really, really clever. And again, sets a bit of a template. Shall we talk about Baylock? Or rather, shall we talk about Baylock's alter ego? The Jekyll to his Hyde. Or is it his Hyde to the Jekyll? It would be his Hyde to the Jekyll, wouldn't it?
Hyde was the evil one. So yeah, he's Hyde to his Jekyll.
To his Jekyll, yes.
Which is very iconic. Anyway. In fact, Terry, you're wearing your
T-shirt. I am wearing my Baylock T-shirt as we speak, my Baylock puppet T-shirt.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an image, this face of Baylock, Baylock's puppet, is such a famous image, not just because of this episode, but because for many episodes, it's the final caption in the end credits for each episode of the original series. I would say it's as iconic, if to use that word, as Vina. Again, for the same reason. And I mean, how does this hold up now? I was watching this last night, and my wife was watching it with me, and she saw Baylock emerge, and she just cackled. She loves the episode, and she loves Baylock, but she just cackled. Not in a kind of ridiculing way, but more in the fact that it was just nice to see an old friend.
Yeah. Something I noticed about it was the scene was very reminiscent, because it was on television last week when I was watching this, The Wizard of Oz.
That's exactly what we've got, isn't it? It is great and powerful.
But it's the same figure, very similar figure,
very similar colour schemes,
the purples, greens.
Yeah, don't have a look behind that curtain over there.
Do you think that culturally, contemporarily, that this is something that audiences respond to at that time, and that's why they chose that figure? That is something that, I mean, I think in a modern audience now we would probably find it cheesy, but I mean in 60s audience, I mean, is there echoes of Nosferatu going on there, or am I really overthinking
it? I think it's just like general
if I'm looking at the face of the puppet now, and it is general evilness, isn't it, really? Just like the sunken eyes, the bald head,
and the turned down mouth.
Yeah, very grim. Yeah, the hook nose.
I think you should compare the design for the Wizard of Oz in the flames to Baylock, and you'll see that they are near
similar.
I must confess,
I never got that at all.
And as you said, don't look behind the curtain, because behind the curtain, you have the guy in The Wizard of Oz from Kansas, and then you have the young
Clint Howard.
Young
Clint Howard. Who I think we can move on to now.
Yeah, one of the most memorable cameo appearances, I think, in the whole series.
Absolutely,
really,
absolutely. And not his last appearance for Star Trek. He made two subsequent appearances for Star Trek. He turns up in Future Tense Part 2, I think. He plays he turns up in there. It's a bit of a cameo. And he turns up in Discovery, Graham.
Yes.
You won't know this just yet. You'll look forward to seeing him, I'm sure.
Oh.
Yeah, he's in the final episode of Discovery.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh,
okay.
There you are. Yeah, you do know something. Yeah, well known for being gentle, not Gentle Ben, obviously. He didn't play the horse. So he played the child.
The bear.
Gentle Ben.
The bear.
I thought Gentle Ben was about a horse. Oh, no, that's Mr. Ed. Let's start that again, shall we?
Yes, okay.
So, Clint Howard, obviously, most famous for being, well, let's face it, Ron Howard's brother. But, I mean, beyond that, he was in
Gentle Ben. And I didn't even know that.
In Gentle Ben. Well, I'm poking fun. But
it's where he gets most of his work.
I know.
Yes. I also have to name drop one of the worst, best horror movies I've ever seen, which is called Evil Speak. of which Clint Howard is the
star.
Yes, there is a reason for that. You know. Let me tell you that Evil Speak can be watched for free on YouTube.
Okay.
anyone who owns that film is disowning it. But yeah, if you've got an hour and a half to kill, then by all means do that. For some reason I did. His drapes, man. Those drapes in the Viserys. Absolutely fantastic.
Well, I know you have a loving for sort of interior decorating and furniture.
Scotty does sell them those short, doesn't he? Because they do have like lots of rooms there with plenty tall enough ceilings, and he has to bring them into the lowest ceiling room possible. All right, so we just walk out there. Oh, thanks, Scotty, you dick.
I was thinking yesterday, because there's all manner of different cosplay ideas that people have for attending conventions, and I was thinking it would be really good if three people just like dressed in Starfleet uniforms of Bailey, McCoy and Kirk, and then just stood in the corridor at the convention, just crouched down for hours on end doing nothing while waiting for people to just walk past them. And Tranya as well is the drink that is served, which is grapefruit juice apparently, and Clint didn't enjoy grapefruit juice because it is quite an abrasive drink, particularly to an immature palate, and that has echoed on. They serve Tranya in quarks, and it turns up from time to time elsewhere. So it's there's just so much that came from this episode. I mean, what did we think about the denouement, the fact that it was all a test? I mean, do we buy that kind of stuff now? That's a bit of an old
trope
now?
Trope,
It is a lovely Star Trek trope. I mean, because it is, we are to discover. I mean, this is what Star Trek is to discover. The universe is full of super intelligent races, and they're all dicks.
Mm.
They're all absolute dicks. This is what evolution has to look forward to.
Yeah.
Human evolution, as we grow and expand, we're going to become complete and utter dicks. You think we're dicks now? Mm. No. Once we become super intelligent and other people start reaching to us for first contact, we can be complete dicks to them.
Staring down our noses at them.
Yeah, we can get them to kill each other and then we can say, oh yeah, it was just a test.
I know, I mean, it's like, you know, it was a pleasure testing you. And like Kirk's like, okay, yeah, well, that's cool. Oh, I see, yeah, great. And he asked the Kirk to say, you know, that's great, mate. Thanks very much, it's great. You're a great guy and we're looking forward to making friends with you. But, you know, you could have totally killed us. You really could.
And, you know, all that thing about, you know, making us think we only had 10 minutes to live. Yeah. What a barrel after
that. That has taken years off my life.
That was a bit lame when the 10 minutes was up and then it just stopped.
I quite liked that. I liked that. And I thought it was quite nice because they dropped in a bit of Alexander Courage music.
Well, I don't mean lame through the story idea. I mean lame from the aliens sort of thinking,
I see what you mean. It was a bit
sort of funny.
That was the whole point of the episode. It is, after all, the Corbinite manoeuvre.
I mean, I was quite interested that, obviously, going back to other Star Treks, the original pilot for Next Generation, because this when Q has that force field, I actually thought that was the same thing as the...
It reminds me a little bit of Farpoint, but it reminds me in terms of its tone and theme as well, again, because, just going back to the theme of it, is that these people have been aggressive towards us, you know, they've almost killed us, they've put us through the ringer, and now they're in danger, and now so we're going to rescue them. And this is
It was another test.
Yeah, but the point is that at the time...
Yeah.
As far as Kirk is concerned, they've just escaped this life or death situation, and now their enemy is in distress. Mm-hmm. And so they render aid to their
enemy.
They then subsequently discover that it was all a test, but he wasn't to know that at the time. No. And again, this is all part of the test, isn't it? Are you the kind of people who render aid to your enemy? And if so, then you're probably decent folk. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a shitty way of communicating that, isn't it? Really, it would have been just simply better to just maybe talk to them.
So do you reckon that maybe in new Star Trek coming up that they should actually do the opposite way around and actually sort of
just
to change the trope, because we've had this trope.
I mean, like, this is what much more advanced alien races are doing. So like this whole like touchy-feely next gen version of First Contact, you know, it's utter crap.
Yeah.
We're starting to get a bit Trumpian now.
This is probably why Discovery is set in the Star Trek past. Because, you know, humans of the future are dicks. Well, I mean, let's face it, humans of the present are
that,
as well.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, there is that as well. Can I ask one thing before we... Before
yeah,
we,
we're going to wrap in a wrap second, up. So yeah. Go ahead.
First Federation.
Yeah.
You know, I was quite interested that when, you know, they came up with that idea about another Federation and the First Federation, because they were the first. Mm. Does that sort of lead into... well, because at the time, this isn't a Federation. Well, we're not introduced to a Federation at this point in Star Trek, are we? When this is originally done.
No.
So, I mean, I think it's quite later on that we're actually introduced to a Federation as such. But is this a kernel of an idea that Roddenberry and everyone sort of decided to use from the idea that there's another civilization already has a group of, you know, federated people? Because we only see it, a united Earthship is what I think the actual Enterprise introduces itself as.
Yeah,
you know,
I suspect that they just thought that it was a cool name, and then when it came to write about it,
they
said, "Well, we need to do a bit of world building. What do we call what do we do with it?" I said, "Why don't we call it the Federation?" So, mm-hmm. Yeah, cool, that's fine.
Considering the number of fibs that the Baylock tells, then you don't even know if the First Federation is an actual thing.
Yeah. It could just be that guy.
It could just be that guy.
Yeah,
on a really, really, really powerful ship.
Yeah, with some fantastic drones.
With no friends.
Yeah, and no mates.
Great interior decoration.
Great interior decorator, but no one to enjoy it with.
Yeah.
Even an alien would be welcome.
Yeah.
An alien with good tasting drapes. Grapes or drapes?
Grapes, yeah.
Is there anything else you guys wanted to bring up about this episode? Covered all the bases?
Yep.
Yeah? You're happy? How does this episode stand up to you guys? Because I didn't ask you this at the front. I liked it.
I think it was really good.
Yes, yeah. very good.
Yeah, it's one of my favourites.
It's always been one of my favourites, and it continues to be. Yeah, if someone puts this in their top 10 or top 5, then I'd have no...
They'll have no problem. Truck from Sibley.
No.
The Sibley police won't be round saying, "Oi, whoosh." No.
Yeah, they won't be getting any askance glances from me.
No, they won't. You won't be turning up there saying, "You are wasting time and effort." Take me a while to develop my Baylock voice, and I'm quite pleased with it. Anyway, right, okay, with that case, thank you very much for listening. And from myself, Terry, and from Derek and Graham, it's goodbye.
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 Thanks once again for listening to Whom Pods Destroy. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and that if you don't already, you'll consider subscribing to the podcast feed. If you already subscribe, then we would appreciate a 5-star review to help boost the profile of the show. We welcome any feedback and can be found on Twitter at WhomPodsDestroy, or feel free to chuck us an email at garth@whompodsdestroy.com. In our next episode, we discuss another fan favourite. So join us as we enter the arena.